KSTP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The Trump administration just launched a direct attack on our union. A new executive order that tries to illegally strip collective bargaining rights from hundreds and thousands of federal workers.
Unions are calling President Trump's move to strip federal workers of collective bargaining rights the biggest attack on the labor movement in U.S. history. We'll speak with AFGE Union President Everett Kelly, head of the largest federal workers union, which is also spearheading resistance to cuts to federal agencies. And we'll get an update on a major labor victory as the Chicago Teachers Union reaches a tentative contract with Chicago Public Schools after more than a year of negotiations without a strike. Then to Burma, where aid groups say there's still an urgent need for rescue, shelter, food, and water after Friday's massive earthquake.
Hello, somebody there? We are stuck in here. Please help us. I beg you, please pull us out.
And finally, we look at the alarming rise in censorship on U.S. campuses and how New York University canceled a presentation by the former international head of Doctors Without Borders.
They were a bit taken aback by my presentation. They were actually concerned that, especially one slide when I'm talking about casualty into the humanitarian aid force last year in 2024, that they were mentioning that some of those casualties were happening in Gaza. And then as well, they were worried about the fact I was talking about USAID cuts.
Speak with Professor Dr. Joanne Liu in Montreal, Canada, about what she'd hope to cover in her NYU address. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's armies ordered the mass expulsion of Palestinians from some of the Gaza Strip's most populated areas, including the southern city of Rafah and parts of Khan Yunis. The orders uprooting hundreds of thousands of people who've previously had to flee Israel's repeated forced evacuation orders and bombings. This comes amid stepped-up Israeli attacks that, according to Gaza's health ministry, killed at least 42 people and injured over 180 people in just the last 24 hours.
There are bombings, there are missiles, and there are projectiles, but there are no means of transportation to leave. We prepared our things but had no means to transport them. We walked. We walked to protect our children's souls. We wanted to take our children and leave with them, not caring about the house or anything. The crossing is closed, and life, do you know, life is hell. Hell, hell, hell. You know, the Gaza Strip is no longer fit for the living. That's true.
Israel's militaries assassinated another journalist in Gaza, at least the 209th Palestinian media worker killed since October 2023. Radio journalist Mohammed al-Bardawi was killed along with his wife and their three children in Israeli strike on their home in Khan Yunis just before dawn. In Lebanon, at least four people were killed, seven others wounded overnight when Israel attacked a southern suburb of the capital, Beirut. The airstrike reportedly came without warning. It was the second such attack in less than a week and came despite a ceasefire agreement Israel signed with Hezbollah in November. In Jerusalem, Israeli police arrested a dozen protesters Monday as thousands marched, calling for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to resign, accusing him of sabotaging the release of remaining hostages held in Gaza and subverting efforts at a ceasefire.
The government has decided to go into holiday, the parliament, while we're still in a war. There's still bad situation going on. The hostages are still in Gaza, and this is an absurd situation, and we want it to end. We're also here to call for elections. We don't trust this government. Most of the people don't trust this government, and it has no more authority to rule.
The continuing protests came as Israeli police arrested two of Netanyahu's top aides, Yonatan Urich and Eli Feldstein, charging them with accepting bribes from Qatar and then laundering the money. On Monday, Netanyahu's separate corruption trial was interrupted when he was summoned to testify in his aide's case. A dual citizen of the United Kingdom and the Gambia, who was twice suspended for joining pro-Palestinian and anti-genocide campus protests at Cornell University, has left the United States following ongoing threats of deportation by the Trump administration. Mamadou Tal explained his decision to leave, writing on social media, quote, "The repression of Palestinian solidarity is now being used to wage a wholesale attack on any form of expression that challenges oppressive and exploitative relations in the U.S. For every person that's remained silent, just know that you are not safe either. Is the imprisonment of those who speak against a genocide a reflection of your values? Is this the kind of nation you want to live in?" he asked. To see our interviews with Mamadou Tal when he was in Ithaca and outside, visit our website at democracynow.org. Meanwhile, several alumni from Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs, SIPA, have publicly ripped up their diplomas to protest the Trump administration's jailing of Mahmoud Khalil, the Palestinian Columbia graduate student protest leader who was abducted by ICE and flown to an immigration jail in Louisiana, even though he's a permanent U.S. resident. He had a green card. Protesters accused Columbia's administration of putting collaboration with federal agencies ahead of protecting students and their rights to free speech.
Columbia loves to celebrate its Vietnam-era legacy. It loves to talk about how brave students were for protesting. But why was it courageous then and criminalized now?
Columbia's vicious crackdown on protest, attempts to silence pro-Palestinian students and faculty, has helped pave the way for the American fascism we see unfolding around us.
The Trump administration's launched an investigation into Harvard University, threatening to cut off more than $9 billion in federal grants and contracts over the school's response to student-led protests in solidarity with Gaza. A federal anti-Semitism task force is expected to visit the Harvard campus soon. A scathing op-ed in the Harvard Crimson student newspaper condemns the response of Harvard administrators as shameful, adding, quote, "Students are being hurt, threatened, and snatched off the street in real time, as our administrators, whose primary responsibility should be defending the well-being of students, stay silent, leaving students to feel that they must fend for themselves," the op-ed read. Last week, the Harvard chapter of the American Association of University Professors joined a lawsuit against the Trump administration over its deportation of international students on ideological grounds. Meanwhile, 70% of Harvard Law School professors have signed a letter condemning the Trump administration for attacking law firms that represent causes and clients opposed by the Trump administration. President Trump on Sunday threatened to bomb Iran unless it reaches a new agreement with the U.S. over its nuclear program. Trump's threat comes even though he unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, in 2018. On Sunday, the Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian, ruled out direct talks with the United States, but said Iran remained open to indirect negotiations. Meanwhile, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, promised a punishing response to any U.S. attack.
The enmity from the U.S. and Israel has always been there. They threaten to attack us, which we don't think is very probable. But if they commit any mischief, they will surely receive a strong reciprocal blow.
China staged large-scale military drills Tuesday off the coasts of Taiwan, surrounding the island with land, air, and sea forces, and what the Chinese Foreign Ministry called a stern warning against Taiwanese independence. As it launched the war games, China's Eastern Theater Command called the Taiwanese president a parasite and released a video depicting him as an insect held by chopsticks over a burning Taiwan. Earlier today, China's foreign ministry called Taiwan's eventual reunification with China an unstoppable historical trend.
The Democratic Progressive Party authorities stubbornly adhere to a separatist stance on Taiwan independence, an attempt to seek independence by relying on external forces. Such efforts are doomed to failure, as they are like a mantis trying to stop a chariot. China's reunification is an unstoppable historical trend. It will happen, and it must happen.
China's military drills come after U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth wrapped up his first official visit to Asia Sunday with reassurances to Japan that President Trump is seeking to boost military cooperation with its allies in the region to counter China's power. On Capitol Hill, New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker is continuing a marathon speech from the Senate floor, warning the U.S. faces a crisis over President Trump's disregard for the rule of law and his efforts to dismantle entire government programs and agencies. Booker's all-night filibuster came after the State Department formally notified Congress it's dissolving the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. Also on Monday, the Trump administration announced it would place the entire staff of the Institute of Museum and Library Services on administrative leave. The independent federal agency provides grants to libraries and museums across the United States. Meanwhile, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin's ordered the closure of the National Environmental Museum at the EPA's headquarters in Washington, D.C. The federal judges temporarily blocked the Trump administration's efforts to end deportation relief and work permits for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan immigrants with temporary protected status. Approximately 350,000 Venezuelans with TPS could have faced mass deportation by early April, but the decision will allow them to stay in the United States while the measure is challenged in court. In his ruling, San Francisco federal judge Edward Chen said Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem's move to terminate TPS for Venezuelans would, quote, inflict irreparable harm on hundreds of thousands of persons whose lives, families, and livelihoods will be severely disrupted, cost the United States billions in economic activity, and injure public health and safety in communities throughout the United States, the judge said. In related news, the Trump administration's transferred another group of immigrants to a supermax mega prison complex in El Salvador, the second such removal from the U.S. in 2 weeks. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said Monday 17 immigrants from Venezuela and El Salvador accused of being gang members have been sent to Salvadoran mega prison Sunday after previously being detained at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. Hundreds of immigrants and asylum seekers have been expelled to El Salvador without due process, with many accused of belonging to gangs largely on the basis of having tattoos. One Venezuelan asylum seeker currently languishing in the Salvadoran Supermax prison was detained and removed for tattoos on each forearm, one that read Mom and one that read Dad. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has admitted in a court filing that a Maryland father from El Salvador with protected status was among the hundreds of immigrants who were transferred to El Salvador's mega prison complex earlier this month. Kilmer Armando Abrego Garcia, who lived in Maryland with his family, was granted protected status in 2019, prohibiting the federal government from sending him back to El Salvador after he fled gang violence. The Trump administration said Garcia was removed to El Salvador, quote, because of an administrative error, but that it could not bring him back to the U.S. because he's now in Salvador's custody. And people around the world marked International Transgender Day of Visibility Monday. Here in the U.S., thousands gathered nationwide as trans and non-binary communities fight back against repeated attacks by the Trump administration. This is 17-year-old Lorelei Crean.
They are trying to criminalize our existence. You see that with even on Trump's first day in office. He passed an executive order declaring that there's only male and female and eliminating the option of X gender markers on passports. That was a direct attempt to erase trans people. Then you saw it with his ban on gender-affirming care for people under 19. That's again trying to erase the existence of trans people by denying them life-saving health care. We see over and over again that the Trump administration is targeting trans people in order to attempt to erase us. And that's why we are showing up, to show them that this is not going to happen, that we are visible, showing our visibility that he is not going to erase us, no matter how hard he tries.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with President Trump's push to end collective bargaining rights for federal workers that have helped to lead the resistance to cuts by billionaire Elon Musk's so-called Department of Government Efficiency by signing up thousands of new members joining protests and by filing many lawsuits. On Monday, the National Treasury Employees Union, which represents workers in 37 federal agencies, sued the Trump administration over an executive order Trump signed Thursday night that calls the unions hostile to his agenda and could block collective bargaining rights for nearly half the federal workforce and overturn the ability of unions to represent them in negotiations or in court. Unions have called Trump's order the biggest attack on the labor movement in U.S. history. The largest federal employee union, the American Federation of Government Employees, says it will also challenge the order in court. This comes after a federal judge recently ruled in favor of AFGE and its allies in another case, ordering the Trump administration to reinstate federal probationary workers fired at six agencies. Meanwhile, another round of layoffs for federal workers is underway this morning, this time for as many as 10,000 workers at the Health and Human Services Department. For more, we go directly to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Everett Kelly, president of the American Federation of Government Employees. To say the least, Everett Kelly, your union is under attack. Talk about President Trump's executive order and how you're fighting back.
Okay, well, first of all, thank you for having me here today. You know, as you know, this executive order uses national security for the actions. However, we know this is just pretext, not justification, because it's no way that you've had employees such as nurses and doctors and scientists, you know, in a collective bargaining agreement for decades. And all of a sudden now they are not able to be in an agreement. You know, that's strictly pretextual and has nothing to do with national security. And this is the thing that. Go ahead. What?
No, go ahead.
You know, I was just going to say this is nothing but retaliation against our union for standing up for its members. But this is our job. This is what we should do, is stand up for our members, because, you know, it's been proven that what this administration is trying to do to federal employees is illegal. You know, and we will continue to fight for the membership. We will continue to fight for America, and we will continue to fight for democracy. That's our job. And we are outraged by this.
Could you talk about to what extent is this historic, these attacks on federal workers? How does this compare to what other administrations have done in the past in terms of the federal workforce?
You know, again, this is, you know, this workforce was under the first Trump administration. He didn't think that that was a need at that time when you had a pandemic going on, when you had crisis in the world. You know, he didn't think there was a need to place these employees under this national security threat, you know, and that's exactly what it is. It's designed to silence workers. It's designed to make sure that employees keep their head down and don't say anything, don't hold anyone accountable, because for decades, these employees have been under contract. It's never been a problem. Like I said, even under the Trump first administration, it wasn't a problem. And all of a sudden, it's a problem. Why? Because we've been winning in court, we've been challenging this administration, and we will continue to challenge this administration. What they don't understand is this: AFGE is here to represent the members. We will be here. We was here before this administration came on board. We'll be here after it leaves. That's the thing that they hadn't understood about AFGE.
Well, since 1978, with the Civil Service Reform Act, all federal workplaces are considered open shops, which means the workers are not required to pay union dues. Can you talk about what's been happening in recent months in terms of federal employees deciding to pay up union dues?
Well, you know, and that's true. You know, this is an open shop. No one is required to pay union dues. When people join this union, they voluntarily join. And over the past few months, People have been noticing the attack on federal employees. They are realizing the need for a union, and people are joining this union. I mean, it's been massive amounts of employees that have decided, you know what, I want to be a part of this union because they see that the union is standing there, you know, in the way. Matter of fact, you know, I just believe this, that if we don't stand, the very democracy of this country will soon be gone. And people realize that. Employees realize that. And so they are now saying, you know what, I want to be a part of this union because this union is standing for America.
Everett Kelly, I'm wondering if you can respond to the federal judge ruling in favor of your union, the AFGE, ordering the Trump administration to reinstate federal probationary workers. Can you explain what kind of union protection for probationary workers have? And let's be clear, there's different kinds of probationary workers. You've got the workers who've maybe just come on board in the last year or two, and you've got the longtime workers who get a promotion. And so then they're in a period of probation. So they could be there for 20 years. They get elevated, and suddenly they're fired.
Yeah, you know, this is unheard of. First of all, you know, to be a probationary employee, just like you said, you know, it could be a person that just been doing such an amazing job that they got a promotion and they've been on that promotion for 90 days or they've been on that promotion for a year. And, you know, this administration come in and said, because you're a probationary employee, you're fired. Right. But this is the thing they need to understand. They're not on probation. They're on a probationary appointment. You know, and this administration was wrong. The court admits that they were wrong. The coach showed that they were wrong. And, you know, we are going to continue to make sure that we point out these irregularities and these illegal actions that this administration has taken against federal employees. These probationary employees was very vulnerable because a lot of them have very few rights. This administration knew that. And so they came after them. But AFGE stood up for them. AFGE going to continue to stand up for any employee that is wrongfully terminated.
I wanted to ask you, DOGE and the Trump administration have pushed this reasoning for their aggressive dismantling of federal services. The federal government is too big. Can you talk about this issue that they claim that there's too many people working, especially since the biggest employer is the Defense Department in terms of civilian employees?
Again, you know, it's just pretextual. It is a way of turning people's attention away from the real issue, because when you look at the facts, the population has exploded since 1970. But the federal workforce is the same today as it was in 1970, in the 70s. So that is just pretextual. That is not true. You know, and certainly, you know, this workforce is needed. The services that is provided to the American people, these are the people that do that. These are the workers. These are the nurses that provide the services for the veterans that need assistance. These are the people that provide the services for the food inspection to make sure that the food we eat is safe, the air we breathe in EPA is safe. These are the people that make sure that the public fly safely. That's under attack. You know, so this is just pretextual. It is not that the government is too large. You know, these are people that are trying to take over the government and give contracts to the big enough buddies. That's the real issue here.
Everett Kelly, as we begin to wrap up, there are protests at every level. You've got, as we speak, New Jersey Senator Booker on the floor of the Senate filibustering. You've got lawsuits like yours and those all over the country, and you've got people in the streets. You're going to be speaking at the April 5th mass mobilization on Saturday at the hands-off rally organized by Indivisible, where there, I think, around the country, there are going to be something like 800 rallies protesting Trump and Elon Musk's what they're calling a power grab. Can you talk about, give us a little preview about what you're going to say?
Well, first of all, you know, we want to point out the facts. You know, we want the American people to know that what's happening here is not what's being said by the administration. What's happening is that there is a power grab because this is about power. This is about an administration wanting to have their way regardless of the rule of law. You know, and it's so full of lawlessness, and we're trying to point that out to the American people. We're also trying to make the point that, you know, if you continue to reach and grab the federal workforce and disallow them to do their job, it's going to affect the services that have been provided to the American people. Because, you know, the federal workforce do their job so well, in my opinion, that many times they are unnoticed. When the veteran get the services that he or she needs, you know, that veteran worker that's doing that work is unnoticed. When the food that we eat is inspected and people are not getting sick by that, that food inspector's job is really unnoticed. When the America fly safely, you know, the workers at TSA, it's really unnoticed. When the air we breathe is good, that work is really unnoticed. So they're doing that job and they're doing it effectively. But the minute that they're not able to do that job and they are downsizing these positions, then the American people are going to feel that. And it's going to be dangerous and detrimental to the health and well-being of Americans. You know, so that's why we are making this rally known. That's why we're asking people to participate nationwide. Like you said, we're looking at over 800 of these events. And I appreciate this Indivisible for doing what they're doing to bring some awareness to what's happening across this country.
Everett Kelly, we want to thank you very much for being with us. President of the American Federation of Government Employees, the largest government worker union in the country. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago, where we're going to stay. Because in a major labor victory, the Chicago Teachers Union has reached a tentative contract deal with Chicago Public Schools after more than a year of negotiations without a strike or threat of a strike for the first time in more than a decade. The full membership still has to vote before everything is final. The deal reaffirms sanctuary school protections, protects the ability to teach Black history, and includes raises for veteran teachers and more. This comes amidst attacks on public education by the Trump administration, as well as concerns about ICE agents targeting Chicago schools. For more, we're joined in Chicago by Stacey Davis Gates, president of the Chicago Teachers Union, also wrote the afterword to the new posthumous memoir by the former Chicago Teachers Union president, Karen Lewis, titled, I Didn't Come Here to Lie, My Life and Education. It also has a foreword by the world-renowned abolitionist, author, and activist, Professor Angela Davis. Stacey Davis Gates, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain the contract victory you almost have secured.
Good morning. Thank you for having me again. This contract provides us with the capacity to move our school district forward in a time of Trump. As you noted earlier, the destruction of the Department of Education is going to have profound impact on the least of these. This contract provides a force field of protection for both our LGBTQIA plus students and our members. It provides academic freedom to ensure that history teachers like me are able to teach about the power of Reconstruction in this country, led by enslaved Africans and the first profound general strike that this country experienced. Beyond that, this contract is a way in which our immigrant students and their families can find safety in sending their children to schools where we will protect them as we have already. The collective bargaining agreement is a very powerful tool to use, especially in this moment, to ensure that people are protected, to ensure that their ability to enjoy the public good has some guardrails on it.
And Stacey Davis Gates, could you talk about some of the other proposals you were able to win, including more funding for sports programs and sustainable community schools?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. Dyett High School in the Washington Park neighborhood of Chicago was closed by Rahm Emanuel, who was the mayor of Chicago. In fact, he closed over 50 schools at one time in this city. We, in coalition with the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization, teachers and grandmothers and order people like Jeanette Taylor, they went on a hunger strike. And in that hunger strike, they won the reopening of their schools. Our union then, in coalition with this community coalition, took their needs to the bargaining table and established community schools. We have expanded the number of community schools as an effort to support and structure spaces that don't have to close but provide opportunity. This year, Dyett's boys basketball team is celebrating a state championship. Again, this collective bargaining agreement provides space for progress. We have a evaluation system in the Chicago Public Schools that has deprivileged both Black children and Black teachers of a very well-rounded experience. What we've done is marginalize those impacts and created pathways to get more Black teachers into the system. While corporations like Target are walking away from embracing Black workers and Black employees, we are providing pathways to support more of them.
And could you talk about the difficulty of the negotiations? Clearly, this was an unusual situation because the current mayor, Brandon Johnson, used to be an organizer with your union. So the union striking against this mayor who was so close to them would have been a difficult situation. How were you able to maneuver with the negotiations with the Chicago Public Schools and the mayor's office?
The power of our solidarity has been most vividly illustrated in our ability to strike. Karen Lewis led one in 2012 that was perhaps one of the most galvanizing moments of our nation's labor history. But beyond that, what we've done is that we've done a few things. We've resisted the impacts of privatization and created spaces through the strike, through negotiating, through the coalition space to create power that enables us to do a lot of things. Yes, we can fight. We do that very well. And it's that fight, the equity that we build in that struggle that has enabled this opportunity to push for something that has been more transformative. We've changed and enshrined in this contract a budgeting system that creates equity, that is embedded in making sure that children who go to school on the south and the west sides of the city, that their budgets are prioritized in a repertory manner. That is in this contract. That's not just built through the negotiating table. That's built through community coalition. That is built through supporting hunger strikes. That is built through taking it to the picket line. It is built through bold, unapologetic love for our city's children.
I was wondering if you could comment on Karen Lewis. You wrote the afterword to the new memoir by the former CTU president, Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis, the book titled I Didn't Come Here to Lie, My Life and Education. It's also got a foreword by Angela Davis. Can you talk about her life and legacy as a transformative leader and what lessons you think are key to draw upon now?
That is a wonderful question. Thank you. Karen Lewis is the blueprint for the type of leadership that we need in this very moment. Karen Lewis took the helm of the Chicago Teachers Union when Rahm Emanuel was the mayor of this city, a mayor that used the public good for the rich. In fact, he and Elon piled around here in Chicago. We had a mayor that foreclosed on public education by shutting down 50 schools on Black children on the south and west sides of the city. We had had a mayor who covered up the murder of a black teenager in this city. We faced a very well-funded neoliberal establishment that was hell-bent on marginalizing everything that we needed to have life and life more abundantly. Karen Lewis organized. She found her confederates and the community and organizations like the Kenwood Oakland and people like G2 Brown and Northside Action for Justice, and built a movement that was based on giving Chicagoans what they deserve. Because if you give Chicagoans what they deserve, the children of this city are rooted and anchored in that. And so what I would say in this moment is that Karen Lewis was fearless. Karen Lewis looked at power and laughed. Karen Lewis created space for coalition. And Karen Lewis led with humility and with the fearlessness of love, care, and legacy.
Stacey Davis Gates, thanks so much for being with us. President of the Chicago Teachers Union, joining us from Chicago. When we come back, an update on Burma's massive earthquake. Over, well, thousands have died. Aid groups say there's still enormous need. Meanwhile, with the gutting of USAID, where is the United States in helping join with other countries around the world? Stay with us. To the Sun by Kaina. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Burma, also known as Myanmar, where the death toll from Friday's 7.7 magnitude earthquake has now topped 3,000, including 50 children who were killed when their preschool collapsed. In neighboring Thailand, where at least 21 people have been killed, more than 70 are believed to still be trapped under the rubble. A video filmed by a teenage girl in Burma Saturday shows her ordeal as she was trapped with her sister and grandma in the wreckage of their apartment building in Mandalay, the epicenter of the quake. One of the girls can be seen banging on the rubble, crying out for help with her grandmother's face covered in blood.
Hello, somebody there? We are stuck in here. Please help us. I beg you, please pull us out.
The girls and their grandmother were later rescued, but the civil war that's raged since the 2021 military coup has complicated efforts to allow aid to reach all those affected by the quake. As rebel groups accuse the junta of conducting airstrikes even after the earthquake, Amnesty International said the military junta needs to urgently allow humanitarian groups unimpeded access to all areas of Burma. China, Russia, India, Vietnam, and Thailand all quickly sent rescue teams and emergency aid. The Trump administration's dismantling of USAID has slowed the U.S. response a day the earthquake struck. The administration said it was firing nearly all remaining USAID personnel and closing its foreign missions. On Monday, State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce confirmed that a three-person assessment team from USAID will travel to Burma this week.
The United States will provide up to $2 million through Burma-based humanitarian assistance organizations to support earthquake-affected communities as an immediate response to the March 28th earthquake. A U.S. aid team of humanitarian experts based in the region are traveling to Burma now to identify the people's most pressing needs.
For more, we're joined by Maung Zarni, Burmese dissident, human rights activist, scholar of genocide, co-founder of Forces of Renewal for Southeast Asia, or 4C, a grassroots network of pro-democracy scholars and human rights activists across Southeast Asia. He's from Mandalay, the epicenter of the earthquake in Burma's second largest city. Zarni, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain the situation.
Well, it is really a triple whammy, Amy. The coup came on the heel of COVID-19. The country was reeling from the lack of serious healthcare infrastructure and massive debt tolls and spread of COVID. And then the coup triggered this civil war, which came on top of a low-intensity anti-junta resistance movement that had been going on for 60 to 70 years, depending on the ethnic regions. And then on top of that, in the fourth year of the civil war, we were hit by earthquake. And the earthquake hit the, importantly, the heartland of Burmese Buddhist majority, the dry zone, including the capital of the junta. So this is really a triple whammy.
And Zarni, how has the continuing civil war and the military checkpoints all around the country affected the ability of search and rescue operations to get to people trapped under the rubble?
Well, three things affect negatively the search and rescue missions by even the locals. Number one is the infrastructural damage to freeway highways and local lanes that have hampered movement of the rescue teams or goods and services to the affected areas. The Zagayan and Mandalay are two major cities, and then the capital Naypyidaw. And then the second is the military junta is rightly paranoid for its survival, because it's losing massive territorial control across the country. So the military junta step up obstacles. They're putting up obstacles for movements of people, particularly at nighttime. And then the continuing area bombardment in areas that the junta has lost control. And so on top of the earthquake, the military junta is bombing large villages, towns, and cities in different parts of the country. And then there are also groups like Arakan Army that is also accused of committing atrocity crimes against Rohingya in Western Myanmar, are taking advantage of the situation and attacking some of the junta outposts. And so it's a really demoralizing and very, very dark scenario we are looking at. There is no state as such. There is not a single actor in Burma that can be considered representative of Myanmar as a state. And the civil society has been largely very much weakened by decades of civil war and political repression, massive poverty, mismanagement, corruption. All of that have compounded the society's effort to come to rescue.
Also, you are from Mandalay, Burma's second largest city. What is the situation there, the epicenter of the earthquake?
Well, we are about, we are across the river Irrawaddy from the epic center, which is near another dry zone city called Zagayan. And people are very afraid of tremors, aftershocks. And these aftershocks seem to be taking place, daily and nightly. So a lot of people are sleeping on the streets in tents under 100 degree Fahrenheit scorching heat. And then there are uncountable number of people buried and I presume crushed under the rubble. So the smell coming from the sadly, corpses seem to be like really, really strong. Mandalay is about two or three million population. More than 50% of the city structures have been destroyed. And then the Zagayan, our neighbor city across the river, 90% of the Zagayan is completely crushed, and then the aid is not reaching there.
Zarni, I'm wondering about aid and international aid. You know what's going on in this country. You were a student at the University of Wisconsin. You have China, Russia, India quickly sending emergency teams, and a meager three-person team from the U.S. hasn't even arrived here yet. On Friday, some workers at USAID's Bureau of Humanitarian Assistance received layoff emails while they were preparing to respond to the earthquake. What are you calling for when it comes to international aid from the United States, but also from all over the world?
A penny, every type of humanitarian assistance from any quarter of the world that wishes to help. The military, to my initial excitement, has said they would receive any international assistance from any country, whether hostile to the junta or not. So I was excited to hear that statement from the junta head made online. But I think, aside from how the military responds to the international offer of assistance, I think we're not even talking about the USAID help or the American taxpayers' money. There is $1 billion U.S. dollar frozen as the result of the February 2021 military coup by the Biden administration. That money, if there is any time that is, good for that money to be unfrozen, it's now. I understand that the Biden and Trump administration did not or do not want to release that money and then put fuel into the raging civil war. But that money should be set up internationally and handled by an international body. $1 billion for earthquake rescue and relief fund. That is something that the Trump administration and the Congress should seriously consider. This is the darkest hour of need for the Myanmar people. Forget the regime, forget the resistance, forget the civil war. We need to get some kind of humanitarian ceasefire for 100 days by every actor involved in the conflict and get the rescue and reconstruction begin.
Mung Zarni, we want to thank you so much for being with us. We will continue to cover this disaster, a 7.7 magnitude earthquake in Burma, the epicenter, your home city of Mandalay. The numbers of dead are 3,000 and counting. Mung Zarni is a Burmese dissident, human rights activist, and scholar of genocide. Up next, we look at the alarming rise in censorship on U.S. campuses. We speak with a professor, a former international head of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, after NYU canceled her presentation. She was talking, among other things, mentioning Gaza and also USAID. Stay with us.
Sees pain. I'm not really sure how it all turned to rain. All I wanna do is pray with you.
We spend so much time on being alone. I just really want you to find your way home. I'm sure you need it now. That you need it now.
And I know scared, but together we'll make it through.
We could be each other's heroes. We could be each other's heroes.
And all I want to do is to be with you. Looking at the photos that I can't forget.
Each Other's Heroes by Amun and Lars Melling. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with a look at the alarming rise in censorship on university campuses across the United States. Last month, New York University abruptly canceled a presentation by the former international head of Doctors Without Borders, Medecins Sans Frontières, because some of her slides could be viewed as, quote, anti-governmental. Dr. Joanne Liu, a Canadian pediatric emergency medicine physician, a professor of clinical medicine at McGill University, and the former international president of Doctors Without Borders, was scheduled to speak at NYU, her alma mater, in March. She'd been invited over a year ago to discuss the challenges of humanitarian crises. But the night before her speech, NYU's vice chair of the education department called her to express concern over the content of some of her slides about casualties in Gaza and cuts at the U.S. Agency for International Development. She offered to make edits, but 3 hours later, she was told her presentation was canceled. In an op-ed in a French newspaper describing how elite universities are in the crosshairs of presidential cuts, Dr. Liu said she was astonished by the institution's posture of preemptive over obedience. Dr. Joanne Liu joins us now from Canada. Welcome to Democracy Now! Explain exactly what happened, Dr. Liu.
Good morning. Yes, sure. So, as you said, I was invited 7 months ahead, and it's my alma mater. It was the first time they were inviting me since I graduated in the 90s. So you have to understand that for me, it was a moment of rejoice and happiness of being invited back. And so the title of the presentation was Challenges in Humanitarian Crisis. And I was covering what have happened over the last year because things have changed. This is a normal and regular lecture that I gave, but I always update it on a regular basis. So basically, I went to New York, and then I had submitted my presentation on a platform. And then as soon as I arrived, because I was living at a friend's house, he just said, by working in the ER at NYU, he said, by the way, the administration wants to talk to you. And then I ended up talking with the lady from the education, the vice chair. And she said, well, listen, what do you have to say about your presentation? I said, not much, but I think you have concerns. You want to share them with me? And then she tells me that there was a slide that she thought that could be troubling the audience, and it could be perceived anti-Semitic because I was showing the number of casualties in conflict zones in aid worker. And it is an extract from the aid workers security database. And of course, there is a fair amount of casualty in Gaza, knowing what is happening right now, but in other countries as well, like Sudan, like South Sudan and Ukraine. In addition to that, she said, well, we think that it could possibly be perceived as well as anti-governmental. The way you talk about the U.S. cut, the picture of Zelensky and Trump. So I let her speak and I said, okay. I said, what do you want to do about that? Do you want to offer me a suggestion where I could either change the presentation, nuances, how I'm going to articulate things? You know what? I'm chill. I'm really chill. I'm flexible. I want this to be a good moment. And then she hesitated. And then I said, okay. And then a few minutes after, I said, let me offer those three slides I would remove. As long as I can keep the key overarching message, I'm fine. I can manage that. And she said, okay, listen, I'll get back to you in a few hours. And basically, 3 hours later, I got a phone call. And the lady was really, I would say that she was really sad. Anyway, I said, I sent some sadness. And she said, listen, I'm very sorry. But we've been talking for the last 3 hours, and I have to inform you that we have decided to cancel your conference.
And Dr. Liu, you were for 6 years the president of Doctors Without Borders, one of the most prestigious medical groups in the world. Have you ever had a talk canceled before?
Actually, when a talk is canceled, it's because I'm canceling it, but not the other way around. It did happen because for security circumstances or changes in, I could not attend, but it happened really rarely. It was from my side.
And were you, your reaction to when they told you it was canceled?
So my reaction was, I was stunned. I actually, it wasn't part of my scenario. I'm someone who always planned for worst case scenario, but I could not imagine that case scenario because these are my friends. And it was a moment of being united. We haven't seen each other for a while. And they send me regularly, email telling me how excited they were. They told me some of our staff, I've seen your presentation a few years ago. They said you brought tears to their eyes because the content is so moving. We are so excited. So I just thought that we will manage to find, I would say, a middle ground in all that. So yes, it's completely stunned and of course disappointed.
So in your presentation, as you mentioned, you included a table from the Aid Worker Security Database that shows one of the places with the highest humanitarian casualties last year was the Gaza Strip. You were told you could be perceived as anti-Semitic if you talked about this, and also if you talked about USAID perceived as anti-governmental. Respond to both, Dr. Liu, and what your international humanitarian work is all about.
Well, with respect to that slide, it was not specifically, I would say, on Gaza. It was the compilation of number of casualties in conflict zone, in aid worker community. And this is what I was trying to explain to the person, because I just said, yes, this is the reason why we don't see casualty on the other side, because it's about aid worker. For the cut on USAID, you just covered it, you know, when the disaster is happening in Myanmar in your show earlier, It's massive. The generosity of US over the last years, if not decades, have been massive. They were covering the overseas developmental aid, you know, up to 30% in terms of humanitarian aid. You know, according to the numbers, it's something between 40 to 45% on a yearly basis. So, of course, when you do that abruptly, there's going to be consequences. And so when you look at the figure, one of the things I was bringing forward is how it's going to impact the HIV/AIDS program, where actually one of the most saving programs is an American program, is PEPFAR, is the presidential program to fight HIV/AIDS. And people expect there's going to be several hundred of thousands of kids who might die and patient. And there's going to be a rise in terms of numbers because mother who are HIV positive would not have access to antiretroviral medicine and would transmit the infection to their child during birth. So it's massive, the impact. And I was just talking because my presentation basically is on three pillars. It talks about how to attract attention when a crisis happens, the security now in a conflict zone and the crisis time. And then the third pillar was on funding.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but there was also news that USAID is moving to end funding for Gavi, the Global Vaccine Alliance that provides life-saving vaccines for millions of poor children around the world. Your response?
Yes, I think it's going to be a disaster, of course. But I would like, before we end the show, the reason why I wrote this letter is the fact that I truly and strongly believe that university are the temple of knowledge, but as well of plurality of ideas. And if we do not allow that, we are basically killing the essence of what university is about. It's about having people to be able to express different point of view in a safety environment, where as well students can be exposed to it and make up their mind. That is what is necessary, and that is what makes a university, even a country, stronger by plurality of ideas.
We do have 20 seconds. You are an alum of NYU. In this 20 seconds, what do you think the students lost in not hearing your speech?
Well, I think they lost the fact of getting a sort of a different point of view of someone who's been, I would say, a field aid worker. So basically, I work from being on ground zero to the leadership role. And I was giving basically the whole spectrum of what it means doing aid work nowadays.
Dr. Joanne Liu, thank you so much for being with us. Canadian pediatric emergency medicine physician, associate professor of medicine.
Dark clouds will break up if you wake up and live. Squad is great for mama, Lord, you gotta wake up and live. Show the stars.